Then came the fall, and fallen men corrupted and perverted and distorted the original revelation that had been given to Adam and Eve. And that was the beginning of various non-Christian or false religions. This distortion by sinful men with their imaginations and with their desires. And the Bible has a good deal to say about these distortions and these imaginations. I won't take you through all the passages. We read a few last week. But there are warnings in the New Testament, as well as many in the Old, about following fables or myths or stories that have been made up by religious teachers, by people who are clever. They can put together a good story, and they can convince other people to believe it. And those folks become religious leaders throughout human history. Look at a few verses, if you would, with me. Let's turn to 1 Timothy, which is a letter, of course, that Paul wrote to his disciple Timothy. It's part of what are called the pastoral epistles, because Paul is giving instructions to pastors, to elders, as to how they're to govern or manage the church. And turn to 1 Timothy, if you would, chapter 1. And let's read a couple verses here in chapter 1. Starting at verse 3. As I urged you when I went into Macedonia, remain in Ephesus, that you may charge some that they teach no other doctrine, nor give heed to fables and endless genealogies, which cause disputes, rather than godly edification, which is in faith. Here's the clear instruction from Paul to Timothy to teach no other doctrine and to teach others to teach no other doctrine. And they're not to pay any attention to fables or myths or what he calls endless genealogies, purported accounts of families that go back decades and centuries and generations and that sort of thing. Now, the Jews, of course, had developed what are called midrash, which are stories that they had made up, purportedly historical. Some scholars, some liberal scholars today, have said that the New Testament has midrash in it, that they're these stories taken from these Jewish fables that have showed up in the New Testament. Well, turn to 2 Timothy, if you would. Of course, another of the pastoral epistles, 2 Timothy chapter 4. And you'll see Paul's repeated command here. I charge you, therefore, beginning at verse 1, 2 Timothy 4, verse 1, I charge you, therefore, before God and the Lord Jesus Christ, who will judge the living and the dead at his appearing in his kingdom, preach the word. Paul's very clear as to what's to be preached. Be ready in season and out of season. Convince, rebuke, exhort with all long-suffering and teaching, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers, and they will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables. Here's again not just a warning from Paul, but a prophecy from Paul. This is going to occur in the churches, not just outside the churches, but within the churches themselves. They will turn to fables, and they will turn away from the word and sound doctrine. And look at 2 Peter, if you'll turn to Peter's second letter, chapter 1, verse 16. 2 Peter 1, 16. Peter says, "For we did not follow cunningly devised fables when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but were eyewitnesses of his majesty." It says we didn't follow fables. We didn't follow myths. We didn't follow these stories that people have made up over the centuries, over the millennia. We are telling you the truth. We didn't follow these mythologies. And that is a major source of non-Christian or false religions, is the imaginations of men. But there is another source that Scripture tells us about that we ought not ignore as well, because, among other things, it's relevant to Islam. And this is found back in 1 Timothy chapter 4. 1 Timothy 4. And let me read the first few verses here of this chapter. Now the Spirit expressly says that in the latter times some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons. It's not just that man is a sinner and corrupts the revelation that he has of God, but that demons teach certain things. And here you have the prophecy that many will depart from the faith and give heed to these teachings of demons and deceiving spirits, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. For every creature of God is good, and nothing is to be refused if it is received with thanksgiving. For it is sanctified by the word of God and prayer. If you instruct the brethren in these things, you will be a good minister of Jesus Christ, nourished in the words of faith and of the good doctrine which you have carefully followed. But reject profane and old wives' fables, and exercise yourself toward godliness. Here again you have this concern with fables, but it's this concern with mythology. But we're given here a different source for these things: deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons. And how is this relevant to Islam? Well, we need then to get into a short discussion of Muhammad himself. Muhammad was born about 570, according to tradition. We really don't know much about the man, in Arabia. And he was married about 25 years of age. He was working for a widow, 15 years older than he was, and he married her. He was sort of a business manager, and he married this widow. And along about 610, when he was about 40 years old, he started having visions, and he started hearing voices. And he said that the angel Gabriel came to him when he was in a cave. It was a habit of his to meditate in a cave. And they even have a name for the cave, Hira. And he meditated in this cave, and the angel Gabriel came to him and said to him three times, "Recite, recite, recite." And then he gave him a fuller instruction as to what he was to recite. But that word in Arabic is Quran. That's what the angel Gabriel said. The first word spoken by the angel Gabriel to Muhammad was Quran. And these revelations from the angel Gabriel went on, according to Muhammad and his friends, for 23 years, sporadically, not continuously. There would be periods in which he received no revelation, and other periods in which he would receive an abundant revelation from this being that he referred to as the angel Gabriel. Now, throughout human history, people have frequently seen apparitions. Today, I don't know that anyone is claiming to see the angel Gabriel, but many people claim to see apparitions of Mary. Perhaps you've heard of Medjugorje over in what used to be called Yugoslavia, where about 20 years ago, some young girls said that the Virgin Mary appeared to them. And there have been many other sightings of these apparitions. And the Virgin Mary gave them certain information at that time. There's a very famous apparition, Fatima. The prophecies there given by an apparition that appeared to some people and identified itself as Mary or some other very noble name. And these apparitions have appeared throughout the Middle Ages. They've appeared into modern times, and people are usually persuaded by them. Now, sometimes this becomes humorous. I mean, this is deadly serious what we're talking about, but sometimes it really becomes humorous. We had, when we lived out in New Mexico, of course, the area we lived in was very much Roman Catholic, and someone had cut the limb off a tree in his front yard in town, and the sap had run out. And someone drove by and saw the sap running out and said, "Well, that's the Virgin Mary. It looks like the Virgin Mary to me." And hundreds of people came. The word spread like wildfire. And we had wildfires out in New Mexico. And the word spread like wildfire, and hundreds of people came. And it became a shrine. They would have their votive candles and their little statues and their little idols there. And there was just a continual progression of people past this shrine, this tree with the limb cut off, and the sap had run out to look like the Virgin Mary. The newspaper editor was out of town when this happened. Now, he was himself a Roman Catholic, but a somewhat irreverent one. And when he got back into town, he heard about all this fuss. And he wrote a column in the paper about it. And he said, "When I was out of town and then came back, I learned that the Virgin Mary had been freed here in New Mexico." I don't know if he was disciplined by his priest or not for that irreverence. But you see the gullibility, the credulity, the willingness of people to believe stupid things. And throughout human history, those who are perhaps cleverer than the rest of us have preyed upon this propensity in human nature. They come up with the fables. They come up with the mythology. And the rest of us believe it. We're sinners. We, as Paul says in Romans 1, we suppress the knowledge of the truth. We give heed to these things. We prefer these things to learning about God. And we see this in all sorts of non-Christian religions. One of the errors we talked about last week was the idea that many people have, and it's been around again for a long time, that in the major religions, they have a common core, common teaching, common ethics, common doctrine, whatever you want to call it. And part of their assumption seems to be, we call all these things religion, so they must have something in common. You know, we call Chihuahuas and Great Danes and Dobermans dogs. So they must have something in common. And in the case of dogs, they do. There are certain characteristics, certain attributes that make up dogs. And Great Danes and Dobermans and Chihuahuas have those characteristics. Now, they have additional characteristics that make them Great Danes and Dobermans and Pinschers. But they have this common core of characteristics that call them all dogs. But this is not the same as with religion. We colloquially call these various things religions, not because they have common teaching or common doctrine or common ethics, but because they have a common ancestor. And that common ancestor was the revelation given by God to mankind at the creation. And the reason we have such a variety of non-Christian religions, I cited the figure last week of 9,900 at the present time, 9,900 different religions in the world, according to the World Christian Encyclopedia published by Oxford University Press. Someone's actually gone out and counted them, I guess. And we have such a variety because the uninhibited imaginations of men have ridden off in all directions, creating all sorts of beliefs, all sorts of fables, all sorts of mythologies. And in a few cases, demons have told men certain things that they have believed. And one of those cases is Islam. By their own accounts, the Quran originated from an apparition. An apparition that appeared to Muhammad beginning in 610 and ending only with his death in 632. Now, Muhammad was illiterate. I'll give you a little bit of his background. His father died before he was born. His mother died when he was six. Again, this is according to Muslim scholars. I'm not quoting anybody that opposes Islam. He was raised by a grandfather and an uncle. For a while, he was with a sort of what we would call a foster family. And according to the Concise Encyclopedia of Islam, again published by Oxford, while he was with that foster family, they received various unaccustomed blessings. Various nice things happened to them while he was with them. And one of the extraordinary things that happened was that one day two men showed up dressed in pure white, and they opened up Muhammad's chest and started fiddling around inside his chest. And then they left. And this was a story told by his foster parents. And Muhammad himself later explained what was going on. He said those two men were angels. And he said it was what they were doing was they were washing my heart with snow because they had found a dark spot on it. And they were making it pure. And then he made an extraordinary statement. He said, in the history of mankind, there have been only two people born that Satan has not touched. And one of them is Jesus, and the other is his mother Mary. They were born pure, sinless, and undefiled. Now this, of course, is good Roman Catholic doctrine. And what Muhammad taught in many cases reflects what he was hearing from the various sects, both Jewish and nominally Christian, in Arabia. And one of the things that was apparently being taught at that time was what later became called the Immaculate Conception of Mary. As Protestants, we tend to think Immaculate Conception refers to Jesus. It does not. It refers to Mary. She was immaculately conceived. She was without sin. She was pure and undefiled. And Muhammad taught the same thing. Now, he's the third man that's pure and undefiled, but he had to be made that way by these two angelic visitors who came to him when he was a child of about six or seven and washed his heart with snow because they found a spot on it. Well, continuing with our story, his uncle, I guess it was a sort of a traitor, and the tradition has it that Muhammad accompanied him on his trading journeys. They went as far as Syria, which is a good ways from Mecca, where he was born. And he heard various stories during his youth. He would hear stories from various Christian groups and various Jewish groups. And he was a clever fellow and an attentive fellow and listened to all these things. He himself never learned to read or write. It was a mostly illiterate society. But he heard these stories from people. And then he became married, what, at 595, that would make him 25 years old. He married this widow and that he was managing her business, as it were. And she gave him six children. They had six children together. Two of them were boys. They died in infancy or youth. And four of them were girls. The most famous was Fatima, one of his daughters. After she died, and she didn't die until 619, this is 9 years after the revelations began, after the apparitions started appearing to Muhammad, he married other wives. He ended up, as far as I could tell from my reading, with about a dozen different wives. Now, the Quran limits a Muslim man to four, but also in the Quran there's a special exception for the Prophet, which allows him to have more than four wives. And he had about a dozen, although he didn't have any more children. He had about a dozen wives. Now, the youngest one that he married was six. He married a six-year-old, but the Muslim scholars are very careful to say that that marriage wasn't consummated until she came of age, whatever that means. But he believed in polygamy. The religion teaches polygamy, and he certainly practiced polygamy. And this was not unusual for that society at that time. It was something that many people practiced in Arabia at that time. Well, the revelations, the apparitions began in 610. He didn't say anything publicly, and so the story goes, until 613. In the meantime, he had convinced his wife that he was a prophet, and she was his first disciple. And then he began preaching publicly in 613 in Mecca, and made a few converts, but there was a lot of opposition. The society was polytheistic, and Muhammad was coming and teaching monotheism. There's one God. And the society worshipped many gods. And there was considerable opposition to him. In fact, there was so much that some of his followers left Arabia and went to Ethiopia to escape the persecution. He did not go at that time. He continued in Mecca, continued preaching. But he himself was forced to leave a few years later, in 622. He and his followers picked up, and they left Mecca, and they went to Medina in 622. And this flight, they left in the middle of the night under cover of darkness. This flight to Medina was called the Hijra. And he arrives in Medina, and the people there welcome him, and the first Islamic state is set up in 622 in Medina. And that becomes year zero for Islam. All their dating is done from the establishment of the first Islamic state in Medina in 622. So they have a different calendar in many ways from us. They have a different starting point for their calendar. They also have a lunar year. That's why Ramadan keeps changing all the time. It never occurs during the same month in our calendar. This year it was, or last year I guess it was in December. A few years ago it was in September, because they measure they use a lunar calendar rather than a solar calendar in measuring their time. He goes to Medina, sets up an Islamic state, and then the wars break out. And it's important to keep this in mind with Muhammad. He was himself both head of this religion and head of state at the same time. And this is very important for understanding the development of Islam later. The wars break out first with Mecca. And there are attacks from Mecca that are repelled, and then there are battles, there are attacks from Medina. And these wars are very bloody. They're ferocious. Muhammad is merciless toward his enemies, and even toward those who do not side with him. There were various tribes or clans in the region, and one of them was a Jewish tribe. And they did not support Muhammad, so he attacked them for not supporting him. They were not active opponents. They just were trying to stay out of these battles. And he attacked them for not supporting him. And he beheaded 800 men in that tribe and sold the women and children into slavery. Very bloody, very merciless wars during this time. During Muhammad's lifetime, he himself was a general. And he had no compunction about dealing with enemies or even those who did not support him as enthusiastically as they ought to, in a very bloody fashion. But 10 years after the Hijra, in 630, he returns to Mecca. And this time he wins the battle. The people of the city accept him as a prophet. They convert to Islam. And Mecca becomes one of the two holy places of Islam for later centuries. He actually goes home. And the people there now recognize him after 8 or 10 years of warfare as the prophet of God, and they accept his teachings, convert to Islam, and the Mecca becomes part of the state that began with Medina. Well, I don't want to get into the history too much of Islam itself, today anyway, but suffice it to say that during the next century, the armies of Islam overran territory from the Atlantic to the Indian Oceans, from Spain to India, a huge empire, larger than the Roman Empire. And there are various reasons for that, which I hope we can get into later. But it was a religion of conquest, a religion of political power right from the beginning. It began during the lifetime of Muhammad himself. In fact, one of the names for Muhammad was Sword of the Lord. He has, according again to Islamic scholars, a couple hundred different names, and one of them was the Sword of the Lord. And certainly he used the sword in furthering his religion. Well, to back up a little bit, if we've got 9,900 religions on the face of the earth, why should we spend our time, especially in Sunday school, talking about Islam? And of course, you can probably think of a number of reasons, one of which is the attack on New York and Washington last September. We all have that very clearly fixed in our minds. Those attacks, which now, at least according to the tapes that have been released, seem to have been planned by a radical Muslim named Osama bin Laden and his network of terrorists. There's another reason as well, and we briefly mentioned this last week, and that is that our leaders, particularly our political leaders, have told us that Islam is a good religion, that it's a religion of peace, that we have common values, common ideas, common teaching with Islam. And we should recognize that. And the leaders have done their best in doing that by organizing interfaith prayer meetings and worship services, at which clerics of various religions appear, Roman Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Muslim, whatever, because we're all at bottom one. And that's another reason for looking a little bit more closely at Islam. Are we all at bottom one? Is Allah Jehovah? Many people say yes. Many people who are accepted as Christians say yes, that Allah is Jehovah. They are one and the same. But there's also another reason, and I'd like to give you some statistics at this point. And that other reason is that Islam is the largest and perhaps the fastest growing religion in the world. Now, let me explain what I mean by largest. If you lump together all Protestants, all Roman Catholics, all Greek Catholics, and various other groups that name the name of Christ, that group is larger than Islam. If you total all them up, they come up to 2 billion, approximately 2 billion. And of course, these numbers are estimations. They're not hard and fast, but they're all estimations. Islam, however, by itself, the numbers vary from 1.2 to 1.3 billion. This is out of a world population of an estimated 6 billion. Again, these numbers are all estimations. You know, the factor of error may be 100 million or 200 million in these estimations, particularly the number on world population. But it is a very large religion and growing, very rapidly growing. And that's a good reason for looking at it. We have, I don't know that we have what we think of as a mosque in the Tri-Cities area. I think we have an Islamic center, which, apart from the architecture, functions the same as a mosque. Does anybody know where the center is? I'm not familiar with it. Knoxville has. Larger cities, of course, have several. Go to Chicago or New York. And it's not just the U.S., but larger cities all throughout the West, what we call the West, Britain, France, Western Europe, all have large mosques in them. And when I use the word here, I mean something that we think of that looks like a mosque. All the minarets and the Islamic architecture, that sort of thing. But many of the Islamic centers, although they don't look like that, they may be a storefront, they may be a row house, they may be an independent building. They don't look like what we think of as a mosque, but they function the same way. It's where the people gather for prayer. And those are growing. In the U.S., we have, again, the estimate is 6 million Muslims. 6 million. Now, what does that number compare to? How many members of the Presbyterian Church in America are there? Any guess? 300,000. You're too optimistic, Neil. 300,000 members of the Presbyterian Church in America. How about the liberal Presbyterian Church, the PCUSA? I guess that's what it's called now. How many members there? About 2.5, somewhere between 2 and 2.5 million. You have to get up to the Methodist Church, which claims about 7 or 8 million, I think, to have a denomination that names the name of Christ before you even get anything comparable to the number of Muslims in the U.S. Of course, the Southern Baptist Convention has or claims 15 million. It's far larger than the Methodist Church. And the Roman Catholic Church claims 62 or 63 million in the U.S. But you can see here that we have a considerable Muslim population in the U.S. itself, with 6 million adherents in the U.S. This is something that we ought to be aware of, and we ought to know a little bit about what these 6 million people believe. Or what their religion teaches. So that's, I think, another good reason for looking at this. Let me give you a few other statistics in this regard on Islam. There are, I believe it's 41 nations in the world out of about 200 whose population is 70% Islam or more. 41 nations whose population is 70% Islam or more. Now that's a significant number. The first of these, and you may be surprised when you see who's in this list, the largest, the nation with the largest Islamic population is Indonesia, with 181 million Muslims in it, in Indonesia. The U.S. comes in at number 32 with 6 million. We're way behind some of the leaders. The second nation, or the nation with the second largest Muslim population, I can put my finger on it here, is Pakistan. And of course, Pakistan's been in the news a lot lately. Pakistan is a self-proclaimed Islamic state. It developed the nuclear weapons about 25 years ago. It was called the Islamic bomb at the time. And it was developed for the purpose of allegedly defending itself against Hindu India. I don't know if you're familiar with the history there, but those two nations were partitioned. One time they both were colonies of Great Britain, but in the late 40s they were partitioned. And the Islamic State of Pakistan was created, and the Hindu State of India. And it was supposed to be a homeland for Muslims, just as Israel was supposed to be a homeland for Jews at that time. And both those nations, Pakistan and Israel, came into existence at about the same time. And both of them were started for religious reasons. One was a homeland for Jews, and one was a homeland for Muslims. India, I think, let me see, is number 3, despite the partition in 1947. India has 124 million Muslims. That's about 12% of India's population. A good deal higher percentage than the U.S. And the number's far larger than the U.S. Number four is Bangladesh. Bangladesh used to be East Pakistan. But then they separated from Pakistan, I'm not sure when, 20 years ago, and became Bangladesh. And they have 111 million. I won't go through the whole list, but you'll see that many of these populations are very large. Well over 100 million Muslims in these countries. The U.S., of course, has we've put our troops in Afghanistan. There's been some reports this week that we're doing the same in the Philippines. We're introducing some troops into the Philippines. I don't think the Philippines even make the list of the top 40. They have a much smaller population of Muslims. But nevertheless, apparently there's some activity there. And the religion itself is divided roughly into three different, what shall we call them, strains of thought. 90% of Muslims are what's called Sunni, S-U-N-N-I. Most of the rest are called Shiites. And then there's a very small population called Sufis. The Sufis are the mystics. You've probably heard the expression whirling dervish. Well, the Sufis are the whirling dervishes. It's actually part of their mystical program to whirl very rapidly and chant. And they became known as whirling dervishes. But by far, most of the Muslims in the world are Sunnis. This is the 90% of them. The Shiites, of course, control Iran. The Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979 was a Shiite revolution. And they differ in a few ways from the Sunnis. They believe, for example, in continuing revelation. The Sunnis say the revelation was completed with the Prophet Muhammad. But the Shiites say no, the revelation continues through the imams, the religious leaders. And they believe in a continuing revelation. They both, of course, pay homage to the Quran. Nothing replaces that. But the Shiites do say revelation does continue through the religious leaders, the imams. Well, why don't I quit here and take a few minutes for questions. If any of you have questions, I'll try to answer them. Go ahead. Well, that's a good question. Are there more blacks than whites converting to Islam? I don't know, but I'll see if I can find out. That in the past 30 years, there seems to be a trend. Of course, we have the Nation of Islam, which was originally led by Elijah Muhammad, and then Malcolm X. And this was certainly an expression of Islam in the U.S. with sort of black racist overtones. They added the teaching that blacks were racially superior to whites. Now that's not a teaching of Islam. That you won't find that in the Quran. I don't even think you'll find it in their traditions. That was a new twist put on it by Elijah Muhammad, apparently. But it struck me that there was a significant difference. The early civil rights movement was led by people who at least named the name of Christ in some fashion or other. But after Martin Luther King died, the movement then turned into more toward Islam and the leadership of the movement. And I don't know what the explanation for that is. Yes? Yes. Angels are, according to Islam, angels are creatures of God, and they are perfect. The Quran speaks of God as creating angels, men, jinn, which appears in English as J-I-N-N, from which we get genies. You know, you rub the bottle, Aladdin's lamp, and the genie pops out. The genie is a jinn. And God created jinn. He created jinn, the Quran says, from smokeless fire, whatever that means. And then there are devils as well. Now, it's not clear that the devils are fallen angels. But the Quran does speak of God creating all these beings, angels, men, jinn, and devils. Yes, ma'am. Well, he was raised as a polytheist. He was raised in the religion of that part of Arabia. And they worshipped dozens or scores of gods. In fact, the shrine at Mecca, the Kaaba, was the place where these idols and paintings and whatever representations of various gods were there to be worshipped. And Mecca was a place of pilgrimage, even before Muhammad. That was there were many shrines like the Kaaba around Arabia, but Mecca was recognized as one of the best to go to. So people were always making pilgrimages to Mecca. And one of the reasons for the opposition to Muhammad's teaching was the people thought they would lose the tourist business if monotheism were accepted. But of course Mecca's doing very well in the tourist business. But that was their fear at that time. These people won't come anymore to worship the idols, worship the gods. So we have to oppose Muhammad. Yes, sir.
It's treacherously consistent now with 1,400 years that with reckless abandon to attack German citizens, even though it's non-militant work. It would seem consistent that they do not make a difference in these Islamic states or in these Islamic nations, or with respect to their neighbors, a difference between the military and the general citizen. So we should not be somewhat, or we should not be surprised if they would, with reckless abandon, attack innocent citizens.
Well, Osama bin Laden can appeal to events like that throughout Islamic history. In fact, the practice of the Prophet himself as a justification for what he did in New York.
John, being an economist for having a great deal of training in that area, do you not find it ironic that God has given them over to themselves economically? These are depraved nations, these are destitute nations, the majority.
Well, most are. Meet that description. A few don't. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, very wealthy. Kuwait, they have a per capita income that makes us look penurious. But most of them are autocratic, dictatorial societies and are very poor. Quite right. Yes, ma'am. Well, that's a good question. There are different, as I pointed out, there's three different strains of thought, and within them there's some disagreement. And we'll talk about their unity a little bit later on, but I think they are, in a sense, more unified. I think it's a very common core of doctrine. They all have to make the same confession. There's the five pillars of Islam and the six pillars of faith that no matter what sect you're in, you have to accept. And you have to practice. In many ways, a religion puts a premium on practice rather than on a detailed creed. I'm sorry? Yeah. Yes, sir. Well, that may be the case. I don't know if there's a lot to it or not, but that may be the case. But in those countries, all the stands there now, north of Afghanistan, and there's, I don't know, seven or eight different stands over there. Those were formerly occupied by the Soviet Union, and they are heavily Muslim in population, quite different from the rest of the Soviet Union.